Ladies and gentlemen, we have a first here on Not Suitable for Anyone. We have, we're breaking new ground these last couple of weeks, and I'm really excited. We have our first ever returning guest, Mr. Drew Barnhart.
Hi, Patrick. Thank you for having me back. I guess it's a dubious honor. Return with another movie that no one has seen.
Well, let's try to change that. So, you were on before, and we talked about your first feature, Murder Loves Killers 2.
Right.
We did actually talk about Rondo, but the audio was just kind of unlistenable. And I didn't want, especially since we were pretty early on, I didn't want to make people kind of listen through that and, you know, worry about, you know, sort of the future of the show and whether, like, that's what, you know, whether we were just going to have poor quality audio. So I thought it'd be better just to, you know, limit the conversation and cut that episode short and then come back and talk about your second feature, Rondo.
Well, I'm honored, so thank you. I appreciate you doing that.
Yeah, and it's been long enough that I honestly have forgotten everything that we talked about.
Yeah, same here. But I have been keeping up and listening to all your episodes, and they've been terrific. So I think at that time, when we recorded first off, I hadn't heard anything. Your podcast was just getting started, so I didn't really know.
Yeah.
You know, at first, I was afraid, like, oh, is this just going to be, dunking on the low-budget movie, you know, type of thing. And then when I talked to you, I realized, oh, you actually have a genuine affection for this, and it loosened me up pretty good. So I think now I'm in even a better place to talk with you.
Yeah, no, that first time, definitely, I hadn't released any episodes yet. I was just trying to get some interviews done and didn't even really know what I was doing, which is part of what led to the audio issues that we ended up with. But now I have 12 or 13 or so released at this point.
And they've all been very good. So congratulations.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. So I kind of have a rhythm here, so that's good. So let's get into Rondo a little bit, because this is a really neat movie, and it's like Murder Loves Killers 2, it's, you know, sort of limited to a handful of locations,
right?
And kind of, you know, the story is kind of tailored around, you know, what can we do with, you know, with these limitations.
Certainly, and I think as we said on Murder Loves Killers 2 as well, that Rondo got made for similar reasons, where we had the locations before we had anything else. So it was then just up to me to tailor the script right to, you know, what we had and nothing more, really. And so that was the first thing. There was no idea before that. It was okay. I can, you know, walk these locations and now come up with some sort of story that we can tell with these limitations.
Yeah, that's really cool. And that's something that Robert Rodriguez, I think, talked about that.
That would make sense for, like, El Mariachi or something. Yeah.
I think it was like Rebel Without a Crew or something.
Oh,
it was,
yeah, I read that a long time ago. Sure.
Yeah, and he had said that I think that was, like, you know, his advice was, if you can't afford, you know,
right,
this, you know, some big, you know, set piece or something, then don't write it. Write a movie.
Yeah, that exactly.
Is around what you can do.
It's gonna make you look silly if you overreach too bad, and frankly, it's just going to lead to disappointment both for the viewer and for yourself later, because at the end of the day, you're the one that has to keep watching this thing for the rest of your life, you know? Yeah, we've definitely taken those type of lessons to heart, even though there's a few, I guess, biggish scenes in Rondo. It was all preconceived as such. There wasn't many surprises in that regard. If we were going to have a big scene late in the movie, you know, the script would probably be a little more modest in other areas, you know. I mean, it was always it wasn't a free-floating stream of consciousness thing, writing and constructing the script. That's always in the back of your mind of what you can pull off and can't with your resources. So it's an important part when you're making a movie with such little budget or a few resources at hand, that's for sure. So always keep that in the back of your mind, even though it might stifle you creatively sometimes. Other times, as we talked about before, it leads to creative solutions to problems, as opposed to financial solutions that you wouldn't have thought of otherwise.
So talk about, you know, sort of the preparation, rehearsal, things like that. Right. So that on the day you have your shot list, you know exactly what you need to get.
You have your shit together. Yeah. 100%. And like in this case, for sure, since I knew the locations, they belonged to a producer on the movie. One was his place and the other was his new place that he was moving into from the old place. And so I could walk those locations frequently, coming up with ideas. Before the movie shot, we walked through with the director of photography and basically walked through every shot. I'd come up with every shot in this movie. And like MLKT, this is also that kind of no net style that I prefer, which means a lot of long shots, no cuts. There's not a lot of coverage, you know, so every shot is specific. And those are the ones we go out on the day and execute, because we don't have that luxury of shooting it from every angle and figuring it out in post. Even, you know, it's not something you'd want to do anyway, in my opinion. But yeah, so we walk through it. I know every shot. The DP knows what to expect. And then, of course, you said about breaking down your day in terms of, you know, the most economically responsible ways of doing it, I guess. You know, so putting these shots in order, the way we're going to execute them and what we're going to shoot first and all that stuff is always worked out in advance. But that's sort of my MO anyway. My favorite part of making a movie for no money or with any money is coming up with sort of the visual scheme beforehand, coming up with every shot. That's when I really get excited, and that's what really turns me on in filmmaking in general. So I actually love all that preparation and pre-thought out stuff like that. It makes things so much smoother on the day when you're shooting, when you know what the next shot is. And you already have an idea of what some of the problems are going to be, even though it's a movie shoot. It's always going to be a million problems you could never think of. But if you have a solid plan, then you always have that to fall back on. And that also means you can improvise from that plan because, you know, you already have a good idea of what the hell you're doing.
And it's also worth noting that, you know, you're not just setting a camera in a place and then shooting a scene. I mean, there's lots of camera movement. There's sure. You get a lot of mileage out of zooms and split diopters and a number of things. So, so just sort of adding to, you know, the complexity of it all, because you have all these moving pieces that you're bringing together.
And that speaks to just what I was saying, that that's where I get most excited in the whole process. Is it's basically writing, you know, with shots before we go to shoot anything. So all those things obviously are pre-planned out. And of course, in this case, you have to know what lenses you're ordering. You have to know you need a zoom lens, or you need these split diopters, or you need this or that for whatever specific day. And again, getting really excited coming up with visuals. And then, yeah, you don't shoot coverage. If one doesn't work, well, you're stuck with that. Luckily, I'm a genius, so they all work all the time.
That's great. So let's get into the story a little bit. You know, one of the things that that I always liked about this is, the movie just sort of grabs you immediately right from the first frame. Like, there's no easing you into the story or anything. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got these gunshots and then this very imposing narration and sort of announcing itself, the movie kind of announcing itself very forcefully right off the bat.
Well, I think one of the key things in the writing of it, too, is that, you know, when you don't have, you know, spaceships and superheroes and all this kind of stuff going on, what you have to do is be bold with your choices, you know, whether that's, dropping you right in immediately, you know, with a big bang kind of thing, or, you know, filling the movie with twists and turns, or the humor, the transgressive kind of black humor, is that that's what you have at this level instead of a spectacle necessarily.
Right. And you're introducing this character immediately with PTSD from serving in Iraq and things. So in a lot of ways, it's sort of similarly poetic in that it's putting you in that same kind of headspace that he is in.
Yeah, you're I'd say you're pretty disoriented like he is. You're seeing all this basically through his eyes for the first portion of the movie anyway, and you don't know what to expect next, just like he doesn't. And then also when he starts to figure things out, everyone else is dubious because of his mental state. is this guy just cracking up, or is this crazy stuff really happening?
And then you follow it up with the scene with this therapist, and that it's not something that we see, you see often in films and TV. I think it's getting a little more common now. I always think back to like the first season of The Sopranos. It may have been like one of the first times where, you know, you had these like extended scenes of somebody talking to a therapist, and kind of broke some boundaries. And so now you see it a little bit more now, but still not particularly common. Of course, we find out later on,
if there's more afoot.
There was maybe more to that scene, but it
and
seems.
Hopefully, we do occupy the one space where the most one-sided therapist conversation ever. I think he utters two words in the whole thing. One is password, and the other is Rhonda, which is the password. Other than that, he doesn't spend a whole lot of time opening up to her. It's more her with her advice.
Right, and there's that great. There's that great voiceover bit at one point where the narrator just says that, you know, that he feels like he's learning a lot more about her than she is about him.
And I hope that's the other thing. This scene you're talking about also takes place even before the opening credits. And I think it's a good way to establish this tone of humor, you know, in a very dry way. All the humor in the movie is super dry, but the humor is consistent throughout it. And I wanted to get that tone. The voiceover does this too. It immediately establishes a tone of sort of emotionally distanced irony to it, where it's hopefully you realize, okay, this shouldn't be taken 100% seriously. It's, I don't know if I should be disturbed or laughing. And again, I like things to sort of exist in that little space.
Because there are, I mean, she's dropping a lot of, there's a lot of jokes and a lot of references, you know, that she, or, you know, just sexual connotations to the mm-hmm. things that she's saying, and she's saying it very, you know, sort of very straight, and then talking also about there was one point where she was talking about like fetish groups,
right.
Fetish organizations around Denver, and she like lists out the names, and it almost felt
baby
almost,
cages, toilet play, hook suspension, rope bondage.
Yeah, and even the groups, like there was Den Fet Life and Fet Den, you know, things, and it kind of reminded me of like that Monty Python bit in, you know, Life of Brian, where like nobody even knows like what organization they are. Like, are they the Judean totally. People's Front or the People's Front of Judea?
Totally. Yeah, absolutely. Or, and this also has a little of that life, I guess it's Meaning of Life stuff, where with the school teacher thing, where you have all this outrageous sex talk going on, but everyone is acting like it's totally normal or even boring.
right. Oh, no, exactly. And so he kind of gets this instruction, and then decides to go fill his prescription, and that's when we cut to the title card, which is actually, you know, we're pretty good ways into the end of the film at this point. I think yeah, it's like yeah. 10 or 15 minutes.
Right. Which is a little absurd in itself, but it's, I guess it's sort of what you were saying about the very opening. It's sort of announcing itself, like, here, you know, this, another bold sort of stylistic choice. Again, go big or go home if you're so small.
Right. There's a lot going on in this title sequence. And mm-hmm. I think a lot of times, you know, opening titles are an afterthought. But, you know, here there's so many different things going on. You've got a split diopter.
Right.
You've got a high frame rate.
Yeah, it's like 180 frames, I think.
And you've it's a reverse shot.
Right. It's shown backwards.
and then the music, you know, to sort of accent the whole thing.
Right. We really announced our main theme there too. And boy, I'm pissed at myself I didn't get a zoom in there too, right? But yeah, that was basically the kitchen sink idea, because I didn't initially have a title sequence in this movie. As we started shooting, funnily enough, you thought, wow, you know, bold opening. And I was thinking like, oh, the opening's a little soft. It doesn't start out with a car chase or an explosion. So, you know, maybe I need a title sequence. And that's when I think on like day three of filming, I decided, okay, here's what we're going to do, what we need. I need a piece of green felt. I need a shot glass, you know. So it was kind of, I sort of came up with that once the shooting had already started.
It's a really cool sequence, because you realize that, you know, you see like the liquid like sloshing around in the glass, mm-hmm. and then you realize that, you know, it's like bullets being dropped into a glass, but it's all done in reverse. So, you know, they're flying out, and the, you know, and the, right. and the water and the liquor is like splashing back in, and And it's all timed very beautifully and very well with the theme.
And yeah, and that is just, of course, it's all one shot too. So that has to, you know, luck has to play a part in there too. But also, since they'd shot it, you know, Ryan, the composer, could, you know, score to it to some degree, you know, and accentuate that stuff. So a big part of that is what Ryan and Scott did with the music to make that even more, you know, synchronous. Is that a word?
Sure. Yeah. And I watched on the DVD, you've got among the commentaries and things, there's one with Ryan where he's talking about the music. And I guess he had said that, I don't know if it was the temp score or just like the sort of the vibe that you had talked about was like Dvorak Serenade for Strings.
That's right. In fact, the whole thing I attempt with classical waltzes, which is very far from what we arrived at, as you can see.
Right. But as one does with an exploitation film like this.
Totally. That and the curly-cued classic calligraphy of the titles. And again, I think we're trying to hint to people, you know, not to take this all seriously. This is sort of a foul classicism. Because
right.
We're about to show you some really depraved thing stuff, but we're going to do it in this sort of classical form or craft anyway.
Right. Yeah. And that's something that's really enjoyable, and it's always kind of a mystery to me as to, you know, sort of how people can not understand something, you know, cannot understand when something is sort of like being intentionally played seriously. There's a movie that I love that gets a lot of hate. It's Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter. I don't know if you've seen it.
I haven't. I'm sorry.
And it's so strange because it's a really strange over the top concept.
What part?
And like literally there's a point, I think, where somebody like grabs a horse by the leg and swings it around and hits someone else with it.
Mm-hmm. And when people are like, well, that's not possible.
But then, like later on, like there's these moments that are very, very like serious and dramatic, and so it's like this mishmash of tones that I think is just hilarious, and I think it was the whole point of the movie. But I guess the other people were expecting that the entire movie should be slapstick and silly, but yeah, so because you see that in movies all the time unintentionally, right? Where they people sit down to make something that they think in their mind is really serious. Like, you know, I'm talking about, you know, stuff like The Room.
Sure.
You know, Plan 9.
Like Ernest. Yeah, it's very hard on your sleeve. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, and they just don't have the self-awareness to realize, like, no, this isn't coming out the way that you think it is. But, you know, but it's still, but people still find it entertaining on another level. And so it's always amusing to me because movies like Rondo are doing that, but they're you know, intentionally, where, you know, you're sort of intentionally have these contrasting tones and people taking things very seriously, and that literally is the joke.
Right. And on my behalf, I'll at least say one thing I don't like, because, you know, some you know, advertising or stuff for it, you know, was trying to say it was some sort of grindhouse type thing, which is not the case at all. I would never ever try to make something that was so bad it's good or ironically bad or something, you know, that if you don't like a scene or scenes, it's because I'm a shitty filmmaker, okay? Not because I was trying to be too cool for school. But I think, yeah, the self-awareness is definitely there. It's there in everything that I've ever done or even written or that kind of stuff. But there, even though it has this ironic distance, doesn't mean I'm not putting any heart into it. I put heart into all these things, no matter how ridiculous they are. And maybe that helps get that balance, get that balance across somehow. Maybe it comes through and, okay, I can tell that they took this really seriously in the craft, in the way this is done. Like you said, the shots and the music, you know, obviously we put a lot of thought into, you know, how we did this thing. But at the same time, there's no way, it'd be impossible for me to ever take, you know, myself so seriously as to, you know, especially with this type of material, you know, it's inherently transgressive and it would be a real missed opportunity to not have some humor and have some fun with it. And I think even though we have these tone changes, where it can go extremely violent or it can be even a little bit silly here and there, is I think that the sense of humor is the one consistent through the whole movie, that if the tones are changing, dry undercurrent sense of humor is always like right there sort of keeping it on track. I'm sure some people would disagree and say, no, it's totally off the tracks. But but for me, that was sort of the guiding line, both in the writing, the shooting, the editing, and engaging the performances, that kind of stuff, sort of keep this tone, you know, and keep this this humor consistent throughout. So with all these crazy twists, that would be consistent.
I think it is. And I think, you know, people that have watched it that enjoy it, I think, agree with that. Also,
I hope so.
So once we get through, you know, sort of the opening titles, we get to the party scene. So essentially, you know, this guy's been told that he just needs to go get laid, and here is an opportunity to go and have sex with essentially no consequences. And if you're not on board, and the movie sort of announces itself again here with, you know, the discussion and the instructions on, you know, what to do and not to do at this sex party, essentially.
Announcing itself again every 10 minutes. It's hello guys, it's Rondo here. And this was always a funny, absurd scene, and watching it live in one of the festival screenings, this is about where you can see people start tittering a little bit, where they're just uncomfortable enough they want to look to the person next to them to see if it's okay to be laughing or not. and then they start laughing a little bit because as one reviewer pointed out, if half of the stuff that was said in this Rules of the Road monologue was shown, then it would be a XXX rating for sure. It's so wildly pornographic and absurd. But again, everyone's listening to it like it's normal, and one guy there is totally, you know, looks like he's bored by it. And you're watching this done so dryly in the performance too, you know, that you're like, what have I gotten myself into? What is this movie? When is it going to present itself, even as a story structure that I'm familiar with? Where is this going? That's a good way of maintaining suspense so early on in the movie.
Yeah, it does, because it's one of those movies where as soon as you think you know where it's going, it does something different.
Yeah, like, whoops, you're wrong. Let's do this instead. Again, it goes back to the writing where you don't have, you know, big effects, or rather big spectacle stuff. So to keep people on their toes, you got to, you know, be a step or two ahead, or be willing to go to places that the average film of this type, you know, would generally not go to. It'd be more like a, you know, straightforward narrative, and instead of really trying to mess with people's expectations of genre.
Right. And so obviously there's something sinister afoot at this sex party, and they don't even figure it out right away, because the first guy goes in to the bedroom. Right. He never comes back out again. No one really questions this in the second
guy. No one really questions it.
and if Paul doesn't go outside for a smoke, he probably just ends up dead right there. Right. So obviously smoking saves lives is the message of Rondo.
That's right. As I light up another cigarette as we speak here. And that scene that precedes it, where he talks to the bored guy, who apparently is a regular at such events, and he is just so over the whole thing. It's like, one at a time. Can you believe this? Too many rules. I feel like I'm back in school.
Right. Right, he sort of like threatens to go home at one point, and then, when Paul asks if he can go in front of him, he's like, no.
Whoa. That's not how these things work. You're obviously new at this game. Yeah, so once the cat's out of the bag, and we do some, you know, voyeuristic De Palma stuff, and outside looking in through the window to see what's going on, then we sort of launch into sort of the next twist or turn of the movie. It's like, oh, it's that kind of movie, but we still have a few more up our sleeves still to come.
So yeah, and so that leads to I guess the first set piece of the movie, which if I remember correctly, I mean, you guys this is just in the hallways of this apartment building.
Right.
Yeah, you know, that you guys just shot essentially guerrilla style.
Yeah, no permits or anything for that stuff, that's for sure. And yeah, that'll definitely kick everyone in the ass to get stuff done.
So you're on the run, and you've got, you know, all this weird stuff happening in the hallways and people, you know, chasing after people. You know, my favorite part of this whole chase scene is when, you know, a drunk girl just sort of stumbles out of a room, and the bodyguard just punches her for no real reason.
Well, good. I guess you could sort of chalk that up to, all right, you're in this hallway. How the hell are we going to get him out of here? Well, this is one thing that I've seen in these hallways frequently. Some, you know, drunk party girl stumbling down the hall. And that provides our guy with his opportunity to escape. So I guess, yeah, having to come up with one of those ways to get your hero out of a situation, but also do it hopefully with a little, you know, dark humor.
Right, right. Yeah, because he's just so distracted by that, you know, because Paul, he is between Paul and the rest of the hallway that he actually has to like go past him. And which seems improbable because the dude is ginormous. I mean, he is the size of the hallway itself, practically. I don't mean that as an insult. I mean, he's just a large human being.
No, which is great. You're actually making me feel good because in real life, Jazz Copeland is just a regular sized dude. Not that big, and but we'd like put him on, you know, apple crates here and there, or you know, shoot him from different angles. So I'm glad it came off that way.
Okay, yeah, wow, because yeah, I mean, he always just sort of struck me as this just a very large, imposing guy. Well,
it reminds me, like, there's that shot of the poor girl, of the wife, you know, when we're listening to all these awful things that these men are supposed to be permitted to be doing to her, and we have the shot of her, and then behind her stands Jazz and also her husband character, and they're both on like half apple crates and stuff, just to make her look that much smaller and more vulnerable, you know. So there's a lot of little stuff like that in there.
Okay, yeah, that's cool. So it's sort of around this point of the movie when he gets back, you know, gets back to his sister's house, and you know, telling her what happened.
I'm trying to explain to her what he thinks is going on.
Yeah, he's putting the pieces together. It was around here. It was around this point in the movie I noticed. There's a lot of directly overhead shots, and there's more to come.
Yes,
I think. But that was something that there's a lot of you know, sort of strange and unique, different camera angles that that we don't get a lot you know, throughout this the movie.
Yeah, I guess so. And also the sequence is a good opportunity to use some of those. The sequence is where he's trying to explain to her what he thinks is happening. And while he's doing that, you know, we're showing basically bits from the scene that we just saw, but now we're seeing them from, you know, a different point of view. And with that, you have license. And plus, since it's what he thinks is happening, you have license to be a little more flamboyant, I guess, with the shots. And structurally, I always enjoy this, that type of sequence, the whole recapitulation and figuring out what's going on is usually something that comes at the end of the third act or the beginning, or the end of the second act or the beginning of the third act, you know, and people have finally figured out what's going on. And I thought it was fun structurally to put that here at like the end of the first act, you know, and that would be another sort of curveball, like, whoa, this sequence that we're familiar with in other contexts is different being played, you know, this far up front in the movie. And that was always a fun tweak to do.
Yeah, that's cool. It's cool. And then it doesn't take us too long to get to our next set piece, which is, you know, when they, because they have his address, which I guess he,
right,
just, you know, in his haste to leave the apartment, he didn't realize and, or, you know, didn't
he
take
forgot his NDA.
Yeah, he forgot to take his copy of the agreement with him, so they know where to find him, and you know, it's at this moment, you know, spoilers for anyone who still hasn't watched, and what are you waiting for? Go watch it.
Yeah, go and watch
it. But our protagonist,
this right now and come right back after you watch.
Right, our protagonist, or who we thought was our protagonist, is killed at the halfway point of the movie.
Out of him. And it's funny, I stretched that out, you know, his death, you know, he takes a lot of punishment before he dies, because in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, okay, people will still be thinking, okay, so when does he make his move, you know, sort of recover and come back and save the day or something like that? You know, that's generally what you'd be expecting. No, we just kill the shit out of this guy. Hard.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's a brutal scene involving, you know, chains and tire irons and all sorts of things. You know, and the line I wrote down, he's still twitching around.
And that's followed even more importantly by a deep sigh. God, they're kind of, all their violence comes with a sort of a, you know, resigned frustration.
Yeah, I think Reggie even just sits down on the couch at one point and just says, "I hate white people."
It's true. Just, like, words exasperation. Never spoken. So yeah, that is a major curveball for people, and I've read some reviews that that didn't like that so much. They thought it was just too jarring. But obviously, you watch this, and I'm a huge fan. And showing it in that case of like De Palma and Hitchcock, it's definitely a Psycho or a Dress to Kill type move to pull.
Right.
But I guess since we're piling on, you know, twists every like 5 to 10 minutes in this thing, that's probably one of the bigger ones to come there, because it shifts the paradigm of the whole story structure.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Exactly does. And we get a great chase with the sister, you know, at this point, where they're sort of chasing her through the house. And at one point, I think he looks in the dryer.
That's one of my favorite bits. See, that's how I know if you're watching it with an audience, if someone has sort of picked up on the wavelength of the humor, if they laugh at that. If they don't, they're like, well, no, she's not going to be there. Like, but if you're laughing at that, I think you're on the same page as the humor in this movie. Yeah. Jazz is not playing this character as, you know, the brightest star in the sky here. He's a little bit touched.
Right. Right. And so you have your act break, I guess, essentially at this point. And, you know, it comes back in with, you know, the sort of the typical, all right, she's gone to the police kind of scene, but you don't actually hear any of the, you don't hear this monologue from the police officer. You just, the camera just pushes in and out on her while we hear like the sprinkler in the background is really what's, you know, the dominating.
100%. I thought that was a more interesting way of doing what otherwise is that obligatory scene that you'd otherwise want to, you know, fast forward through. It's like, of course the cops aren't going to help. So, and we even do that with him earlier after the party stuff, where he calls the cops, and of course they're not helpful. So you just basically have to plow through that stuff. But I thought, okay, so let's come up with an interesting way that I haven't seen that old scene done before. We've seen that sequence a million times, but come up with some way to make it more interesting with what we have.
Yeah, it is interesting, and also like those scenes, you know, they're in every movie, and they don't matter. I mean, they're really usually they're just there to keep people from saying, why didn't they go to the cops?
Exactly.
But they otherwise they serve no purpose. And I think, you know, sort of muting and mumbling the dialogue there, you know, kind of speaks to that. Like, hey, these scenes are pointless, dumb. It doesn't matter what they're saying because we already know what's going to happen.
Exactly. And so what really the real importance that you can, you know, derive from that scene, if you have to have it, is what's going on sort of in her head and her building anger or rage or what have you. And then using the sprinkler and, you know, distorting that and bringing up the levels and taking down the level of the dialogue is speaking more. It's telling you the scene's not about what some cop is saying, cop speak. You know, it's about what's, you know, boiling under the surface of Brenna, of the lead actress.
Right.
And I think she did a great job just acting with her face in that, you know, because we don't cut to the cop or anything. And like you said, it's just pushing in and out on her, and we can see very subtle sort of changes or what have you on her face.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I don't know if you know this or not, but that monologue, the cop's monologue, is, for whatever reason, it's actually captioned
Is it?
On the DVD. Yeah. So if you turn on the closed captions, you can.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. And I didn't, so I didn't write the whole thing down, but I did think it was interesting that his whole little spiel to her begins, it sort of begins and ends with him using the phrase, or some variation on the phrase, a good-looking girl like you.
Right, right.
It's a very misogynistic kind of, you know, speech.
Yeah, and I wrote the whole monologue knowing that it was going to be, you know, faded out from the beginning, but I just did not want to make the cops, you know, helpful in any possible way, and it's just more of the same as far as what, you know, she's dealing with. There's a lot of that toxic masculinity muck running through the whole movie, you know, from the whole party situation, all the, and you know, now she's even getting, we're even getting it in there from the cops, you know. Not to say this is the most dynamic, you know, female empowerment movie ever, but it's definitely getting those themes in around the edges, you know, in the margins as much as I could, even if it's, you know, drowned out by the sprinkler. That's funny that it's captioned. I didn't know that.
Yeah. I thought that was interesting. So, yeah.
And then I should say also, it's funny now that you mention it, you know, we do that earlier with the Paul character right after he gets back, and I use the narrator then too for the same purpose, saying Paul did indeed call the police, you know, instead of what they say, you know, they're not going to help him, but it was the best call they had received in many weeks. That kind of,
yeah.
Like, get rid of, you know, get through that stuff. It's just obligatory.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, this is when we meet Paul's father.
That's right.
And they sort of team up to try and, you know, solve this mystery and figure out these people, and realize that, well, she realizes that, you know, that she was tricked, and things don't go as well for Paul's dad.
No, and this is another one of those Hitchcock lifts, you know. I always love in this genre, and Psycho is a great example of it, of the character who shows up halfway through. And you sort of feel like, oh, well, this guy's going to get to the bottom of everything. This guy's going to solve it, like Arbogast and Psycho. It's like, oh, we have, you know, a guy that shows up and it really seems like he's going to get down to business and solve this. And then, of course, immediately just gets slaughtered.
Right. Well, because we know things are, but this is actually like a tense scene, because we see them both at the same time, you know, sort of going to their respective locations. And, you know, and we're expecting, we're expecting the sister to show up and talk to the fake therapist. And so when the dad knocks on the door and she answers, all of a sudden we're now worried for her, right? Cause she's walking into the lion's den, but no, it's something, you know, it's something completely different altogether.
Right, a little more expectation foiling. And in structure, obviously, I was ripping off Jonathan Demme's great cross-cut in Silence of the Lambs, you know, where you think that the SWAT team showing up at one house and really they're showing up at another, you know. So this was the lo-fi, low-budget, you know, rip-off of that structure. But you have these sort of double reveals on the end of it, and that makes it kind of fun, like, oh, no. And then that leads into the bathtub where our father meets his fate pretty gruesomely.
Right, he does. And as there's this great moment, I don't know if it was ad-libbed or if it was, you know, sort of scripted this way, but, you know, where he screams out communist as he's being, like, dragged off to the bathroom.
I am 100% sure that was an ad-lib on the actor's part, but I kept it in, like, yeah. Why not? It's funny.
Well, and she just rolls with it. She's like, that's my husband, not a communist.
That's right. That's her ad-lib, too. You know, when all these shots, as we've mentioned, are so... you know, pre-thought out, and this is what the shot's going to be, we're not going to change on the day, that things can get pretty uptight or too strict or too stiff if you just stick to that. So within those shots, I always thought it's good to have a few, let a few things that be fresh, you know, be fresh and not things that aren't scripted, whether it's the actors saying something or something that happens to be there on the day. Do something to make sure that stuff has life, so it's not just all rigidly planned, you know, and stiff.
Right. So yeah, so this is a gruesome scene, and it sort of ends with you know, this gas can, which, you know, in this sort of sort of urban apartment, that somebody would just keep a full gas can on hand.
God knows what fetish that was for.
And I don't know if you can, you know, if you can set off a, if you can light someone on fire in a, you know, residential apartment complex and not, you know, set off alarms and sprinkler systems. And
I never tried, but you can get back to me on that.
but that's a great scene. And immediately afterwards, we see, this is where we finally start to see a little bit of their, of their marriage, the, you know, sort of the evil couple here. And she seems visibly annoyed, I guess, that people are showing up at their house, you know, that this is sort of how sloppy they've been, that they let someone,
right.
they let someone
get
away. Not to
mention she's heavily pregnant and irritable, I'm sure. But... yeah, clearly she's the, do I have to think of everything, you know, around here kind of dynamic in this. She's definitely the brains of the outfit, I'd say.
Right.
And again, yeah, when they kill him, it's just more like a resigned thing, not any kind of enthusiastic bloodlust. And it's just like, oh boy, now we have this more shit we got to deal with.
I guess they get kind of lucky in that she ends up coming to them instead of, you know, instead of them having to go out and
hunt her down.
And hunt her down. And that's another great scene. There's several great scenes in here. You know, you have the patio scene. And you have, you know, her, you know, sort of discussion about, you know, this party that she wants to arrange, and which I assume is part of her, you know, plan to entrap them somehow.
Yeah, exactly. Sort of infiltrate the lion's den as offering herself as some sort of submissive or rather commissioning this crazy fetish thing, but with herself as the main player, because she would know that would intrigue them enough to, you know. To get in close enough to maybe get these guys. But of course, as soon as she gets there, her gun is immediately taken away and she's found out pretty quick.
Yeah, well, because there's this tension that's created because you don't really know what Reggie knows.
Right.
You know, he could just be going along with, okay, this is another client, you know, a new customer. And they go out on the balcony and you have this zoom shot where, like, literally every major character that's still alive is in this one shot, because we see, you know, we see the wife, you know, crossing the street, on her way to the building. So we know that she's about to get there, and the whole thing's going to get blown wide open.
Yeah, we know when she gets there that she knows who the sister is, you know, and our heroine is in grave danger of being discovered. But like you said, we don't know how much Reggie knows. And I love that shot, by the way. That was actually the first shot I came up with for the whole thing, even before there was the story ideas. I was out on that balcony with my friend who owned the place and just sort of casually said, standing there, wouldn't it be cool if we had a shot, you know, from a crane or a jib arm here, you know, that looks down on someone here on the 12th floor balcony, and we zoom past them, and there's someone on the 8th floor balcony, and we zoom past them, and there's someone on the street below, and they all... you know, mean something to the story in a different way. And that was the first idea. And I sort of reverse engineered stuff so I could do that shot.
Yeah, that's really cool. And it is a fun shot, and it narratively sort of serves the moment, like I said, because it introduces this sort of tension where she kind of walks in, you know, throws her purse down and rolls her eyes. And she's like, that's the sister. And then we pan over to Reggie, and he's got a gun in his hand. He's like, because he already knows.
He knows. He's like, And it's fun, too, because you know in just about 99% of other movies with a scenario like that, it would be more urgent. It'd be like, it's her. That's the sister. Or something. But no, in this, it's befitting the dry humor. She just comes in like, oh, that's the sister.
Right. So now the tables sort of turn again.
Mm-hmm.
Because I guess, at this point, maybe we're done trying to guess at what's going to happen because we've been punished for that.
Settle down into a structure we're familiar with at least. And I like, and this goes to that shot again, the big wide shot is one thing I always love with Hitchcock is, you know, he's famous for these, you know, extravagant shots and stuff, but he always waits for like the most dramatic moment to employ them. I suppose to now where every single shot, no matter what's going on in every movie, is some extravagant shot. It seems like, you know, there's not, you know, it's not like, it's like you're playing, you know, your stereo on full blast the whole time. There's no quiet set off the loud stuff. And the idea that was, if you're going to do this cool shot, make it like a key moment, make it a key dramatic moment. I think after that, like you're saying, that's when we can finally settle down into where the sort of third act is going here and just relish in that. This revenge part of the structure.
Right. Yeah. Because this is, I guess, like you said, finally a somewhat familiar structure because we've got our heroine or our protagonist in this impossible situation.
Right.
Where she's infiltrated the lion's den, but she's been discovered before she was planning on being discovered.
We bring all the main players in there, all the baddies, everyone back at the scene of the crime here.
Right. Yeah. And I love that you've got this party and, you know, someone brought cupcakes.
I don't know what that's all about. If you're looking for answers here, you're out of luck.
It's like,
It just came from a joke that me and Ryan always had of sweet cakes truck. And I don't know how. I think I probably just threw that in there. I need something here. Okay, what about sweet cakes truck?
that's what you do, I guess, if you're having some people together for some music and some rape and some murder, then you need sweet cakes to go with it.
I don't know what you do, but if you don't have sweet cakes, you're doing it all wrong.
Right. So, but that's always a great moment. And, but then the music in this scene always cracks me up.
This is, what's this one? This is, oh, what's the name of this one? This is, It's a Crime.
Yeah.
Me and Ryan, as you know, from Murder Loves Killers 2, we always try to get some original songs in these things. And we usually have a blast writing these together that are very absurd usually. And in this case, yeah, It's a Crime was one that he brought in a French singer to do. And I
was going to say, yeah, part of it's in French.
Mm-hmm. and it gets real. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
I would say the parts you can understand, like, are like literally narrating what is happening on the screen.
I think Ryan called it the never ending story approach or something. You know, it's like, you know, stand, if you please, and follow me this way. If that's, you know, what that thing. So we had some fun joking around with that kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah, it's great. It's great stuff. It's a lot of fun, and it's one of those things where you know, you may not even notice, you know, the first time through the film.
Yeah, see, that's a problem. That's why we need to get more people to see it the first time. That way they can go back and see it a second.
Yeah, well, I've noticed that, you know, it's one of those that I can see different things in it every time I watch it. Like a lot of the jokes and a lot of the things are layered. Are layered in here. It's you know, it's sort of like, I think Will Ferrell does this a lot. You know, I mean, obviously his movies have a wildly different tone, but they're the kind of things where you watch it one time and you're going and you're like, oh, okay, that was okay, that was kind of good. And then you watch it two or three or more times and you start to pick up on more of the jokes, and you know, by the third or fourth watch it's hilarious.
Yeah, and then hopefully every sort of behavioral thing becomes funny. You know, like looking in the washer dryer or whatever, you know, or like it might not be things that are sad, but other behaviors start to become funny now that you know what wavelength the movie is on. And I think that speaks again to the preparation and stuff and how specific everything is. There's really not a lot, you know, left to accident or chance in that regard. You know, if you're gonna, you know, if you have such limited resources and this is what you have, you're going to try to pack it with as much stuff as you can, you know, to make it fun for the audience and fun for you doing it. You know, you're cracking up with the people on the set when we're, you know, doing stuff that no one will ever notice, but we find funny in the moment. It keeps people's enthusiasm for the project up, you know?
Right, right. Yeah. And like, you even start to notice things like camera movement. Mm-hmm. There's a great moment a little bit earlier. We kind of talked past it already, but you know, like when the dad is trying to find the right apartment,
right.
You know, and he, like, the camera's following him around and he goes around, he turns a corner and the camera just stays put. And then he comes back and starts going the other way because the camera already knows that he's gone the wrong way. He's just waiting for the character to catch up and figure out.
Exactly. Like, you know. And that's a good example of two things that we've been talking about. One, that's something that I didn't have planned in the shot. That's something that I came up with right there on the bit, just to not let, you know, it seem so uptight. I just thought it'd be funny, you know, like, oh, this would be good. And two, it goes to, I think I said it in the commentary, the Hitchcock thing about the camera that has its own intelligence. Like, the camera knows the story. Like, I think in Psycho, where after you know, Janet Leigh's been killed in the shower, and the camera then moves to the newspaper with the money in it, then moves to the house. The camera's not following any character or anything. The camera is moving with its own storytelling intelligence, and it's not motivated by anything on screen necessarily. And in this case, it's, yeah, oh, dude, we know you're going the wrong way. So we just hang out, wait there, comes back, he looks at the directions, and then, okay, now we can keep following him. And then we resume following. So I love it, a camera that moves with its own intelligence.
Yeah, and no, it's it was really fun. It's really fun stuff. So, you know, she then sort of gets the chance to sort of take the upper hand here because they've let the dumbest person in the crew alone with the victim.
Some might say this is a bad delegation of power.
Yeah, like maybe next time have one person hold the gun and a different person, you know, draw the syringe.
But why let flagrant reality get in the way of fun?
But it results in this fun scene because, of course, he ends up getting the dose of, you know, this paralysis drug, whatever it might be,
whatever crank it is, yeah.
And which leads to some fun reactions. I think from this point forward, you know, there's no more music in the movie, right? Until the closing credits.
That's right. Yeah, at this point it was like, okay, this is this next sequence. There's some, you know, some atmosphere type music in it, you know, some sub-frequency bass, things like that. But yeah, no more music from here on out until the very end. And this is when they move, quote unquote, downstairs into this sort of parking garage or warehouse type scenario where she's got them all on the business end of her dad's AK-47.
Right. Right. And just like Murder Loves Killers 2, I mean, you really end with a punch here. And, you know, whereas, you know, but this is a really hefty punch.
Yeah, I see. I'm with you 100%. Like, after MLKT, I understand the importance of ending with a big punch. And from the beginning, we knew this is how I wanted to end it. But that also meant some creative budgeting, because this is by far the most expensive scene in the movie, given the squibs. We wanted Paul Verhoeven squibs here. We didn't want any pussy squibs. We wanted the Verhoeven stuff, and that stuff cost. And so this 5 minutes or whatever definitely became the most complicated and largest scene to shoot in this whole thing. We shot this whole thing in like 18 days, and we shot, I'd say, 86 pages of the script over the first 15 days. And then the last three pages, which is that scene, we shot in 3 days. So we slowed down drastically to do all the squibs and effects work there for that last 3 pages, the last 5 minutes of the movie.
Yeah. And I think you've got more high speed camera work here in this one.
Sure.
Too.
Yeah, I got some Peckinpah stuff there, I guess. And the Peckinpah style of editing too, which is fun to play around with. Basically just go to town on this. I wanted, you know, they all these bad guys are so irredeemably vile. They definitely all deserve their own extended comeuppance.
Right. And they do, you know, she, it's really enjoyable to watch, you know, she kind of neutralizes each of them and then, you know, sort of turns on each one sort of in turn. To finish it off.
And that's one of my favorite fake outs too, is when she shoots Jenna, Cassie, this therapist, in like the shoulder, and you think, oh boy, Rondo's pulling its punches, isn't it? They're not gonna, you know, kill the pregnant lady, that's for sure.
Right. And it does make you think that at first it was sort of right before that, or maybe before she really started shooting for the first time, where, you know, the Reggie kind of tells her, like, well, you know, there's two kinds of people in this world, and, you know, and you're not this type, you can't do this. And the narration is like, he was right, just not today.
Then it's on. And boy, it's fun doing that, because the effects guys were great, because, you know, first they gave us a standard squib, what would be considered realistic for an AK-47. They even told me that. And I was like, okay, that's fine, but no, we want Verhoeven squib. So they ended up doubling all the squib hits, you know, for everything, until, you know, they were just like, whoa, this is over the top. And we had so many squibs on these people, especially the Mr. Tim character. I think the guys had said they hadn't put this many squibs on someone before. That's always something that the actor loves to hear right before you call action.
Right. Right, yeah, because it does. It gets way over the top, but it's
you're at the end, let's go for it, right?
Yeah, yeah. And you're at the end, and it's sort of one of those things, like my kid is you know, he's in like seventh grade honors English right now. So, you know, they're like learning about story structure and things like that. So if you think of, you know, in terms of like your climax and then your falling action and stuff, I mean, they're really, it's all climax. And then, you know, and then title card, or, you know, then, you know, the end credits, it just, there's no falling action at all. It just ends right at that.
End on your high point, kind of like MLKT, you know when to get off the dance floor, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, end at a high point, so that's it, roll credits. And I think that as far as structure goes too, even though the whole movie is absurd to me as usual, I'd say the absurdity is slowly getting turned up, you know, throughout the whole movie. And so we end on it at a tightest.
It's like the proverbial frog in the frying pan. Yeah. Where you don't even realize that, oh, okay, we're boiling, we're cooking now. And, and it's kind of appropriate that it ends that way. And it ends there because, you know, that's, if you're the frog in the pot, like you're dead at that point before you even realize it.
We're not going to have an epilogue explaining all the backstory and the plot holes or whatever. No.
I actually watched a movie. I won't call it out. But I did see a movie, like in the last year or so, that actually did that. Like it ended at the perfect moment, you know, kind of like Rondo, and then the credits were rolling, and I'm like, oh, that was really good. And then all of a sudden, the credits stopped, and the movie started again, and like there was this whole 5-minute exposition scene where they explained everything that like I had already pieced together. I'm like, no, I already understood that that's what happened. Like I didn't need someone to come on screen and say, well, that was her brother, and that was, I'm like, what? they ruined the movie. And I,
Simon Oakland psychiatrist scene from the end of Psycho.
It was worse than that. But yeah, I just couldn't believe it. I'm like, why did you had the perfect ending and then you just blew it?
You fucked it up.
And the fact that it came after the credits started rolling made me kind of think that, you know, there was some producer or some, you know, someone somewhere along the line said, oh, you have all this unresolved stuff, you need to explain it. And
well, there's only one time off the top of my head that's worked out, and that's Wild Things. Where during the credits, you go back to see how the whole conspiracy was put together, and that's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
It's just like a fun, it doesn't hurt the movie.
Right, right. Yeah, that can be fun. And even like stuff like, you know, even stuff like Tarantino, you know, sometimes where they come back and show you things from different angles, like Jackie Brown or something sure, like sure. that. But I don't know, this was something that was one, it was pretty obvious if you're paying attention to the story at all.
You could put this together.
You could put it together. And two, it wasn't really interesting to begin with. And if they left it open-ended, it would have been just fine.
That's the thing. I've read some reviews of Rondo where they're like, boy, how did Cassie, the therapist, get in this position to assimilate herself, you know, or all this backstory questions. I'm like, man, I wanted this movie to be, you know, sort of like a rollicking, you know, ride, just going from one lurid pleasure to another. You know what I mean?
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. And that's what you get. And yeah, I don't know. I understand. I guess some people are, you know, maybe look for more than that, but it'd be
the equivalent of having that, the obligatory cop scene again and again.
Right. Right, yeah, it's just not necessary for the story you're telling.
Especially if you want to end on a big bang, which we do. It's like, hey, man, what are you going to go from here? What you're going to? This is the way you want to send people, you know, out on.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So that's Rondo, everyone. The other thing I forgot to mention, there's this in the very beginning. There's this great scene, you know, where when Paul starts having a panic attack. And, you know, the dog sort of comes over to comfort him.
That's Alfred, the late Alfred.
Oh,
he was sort of our mascot for that. It makes no sense to have him in there, but I was determined to get him in there, you know, just for the sake of it. So, yeah, if you're wondering why we never see the dog again, for a minute in the script, I had another scene or two with him. But, you know, this is not a trained movie dog. He's a big dopey basset. And quickly realized this was not going to be practical.
Yeah, no, but it is a good scene because that is a real thing. Like people, I know, you know, like I have, you know, friends that, you know, have that served in, you know, in Afghanistan and you know, and they have, you know, therapy dogs or, they're actual, They're actual like trained service dogs where like they can can detect when a panic attack is coming so that they can, you know, start to recognize it and get help. It's a really amazing thing.
Absolutely. That's wonderful. So. And yeah. So I'm sorry, I wish I had more of Alfred or Fred in there. But yeah, just wouldn't have been practical. But again, it's the idea. And I've had my anxiety attacks too, where you feel like you're having a heart attack and can't breathe. And that's definitely what that was playing on. Only he has much more, being a veteran, he has much more cause than I do. And it sort of starts the movie in sort of a sober reality, you know, of this is a real thing. But then that goes to turning up the absurdity. You start from somewhere there that's more grounded in reality, and then by the end, here we are. We're pumping people full of bullets instead of a squid porn extravaganza.
Right. Exactly. So, well, listen, man. Thanks for coming on and and talking through this a little.
People see this thing, because actually I like this one. I know it can sound like an asshole if you aren't self-deprecating enough about your movies, and I certainly am. No one, believe me, no one sees the low budget problems more than I. But this one I was proud of. There's not a whole lot I would change, and I like it. It's just definitely not for everybody. But if you have a particular sense of humor or appreciation for, you know, this kind of a genre, for these kind of genre pleasures, being sex and violence and transgressive attitudes and all that, then I think you'll get a kick out of it.
Yeah, no, it is.
Folks, come on.
Yeah, it is. It's a lot of fun. And you should like your movies, because if you don't like it, then why would anyone else, right?
I'm the one that has to watch it forever. Right?
So Drew, is there anything else you want to plug or anything you want to talk about, things you're working on or, coming next?
I guess you can find this on Rhonda. That is, you can find on what, Amazon Prime, right? Or you can get the DVD, or, you know, whatever, it's out there on streaming platforms and stuff. So give it a shot. Check it out. I'm always working on something new. This new one is, I can't talk too much about it, but I'll just say that as opposed to Rondo, this time we're going for dark and funny.
Okay. And absolutely. I highly recommend the DVD, especially if you're the collector type or the type who likes, sort of the behind the scenes stuff. There's some good bonus features on there and fantastic. We didn't talk about the artwork at all, like lobby cards and the posters and stuff, which is also fantastic.
Yeah, those the posters and lobby cards were all done by Stephen Romano, who did the book Shock Festival, among many others, and he also did the posters for Murder Loves Killers 2, so I knew him from that. We knew this one was a much harder sell. This wasn't a slasher movie, so how do you sell something when, you know, suppose the main characters get killed so easy? So that was a tricky one. And he did those, and then Brooke Spiegel did the portrait art of our baddies and stuff. That's also on the DVD. And so yeah, we had some good artwork going into it, and I guess adds to the spirit that this is a Pulp Noir, you know, style of a game before you go into it. Hopefully when you go into it blind, you don't know what's coming next, and the artwork doesn't really tip our hand too much. One of the strengths of Rondo, I feel, is how close we play our cards to the chest.
Yeah, definitely does. That artwork definitely does the movie a service in that way, and it just looks good on your shelf, guys.
Right on.
Absolutely.
It does. Buy that shit.
All right, Drew.
But thank you, Patrick, for giving me the opportunity to talk about it. I like this one, and I hope more people check it out, and hopefully they like it too.
Yeah, I hope so. And thank you, everyone, for checking out the episode. I really, really appreciate it. Please give me your feedback. Hit me up on Twitter, @BenHorror, or @NSFAPod. And email is notsuitablepod@gmail.com. All right, Drew, really appreciate it. You take care, man. Thanks again.
All right, thanks, Patrick.